WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
When Paul Krasner is called the father of the underground press, his response is to demand a blood test. Krasner published and edited the magazine The Realist from 1958 to 74. He described it as a magazine of free thought, criticism, and satire. Pieces that were too radical or controversial for the mainstream press found a home in The Realist. Lenny Bruce, Gene Shepard, Kurt Vonnegut, Terry Southern, Jules Feiffer, and Abby Hoffman were some of the contributors. Krasner also published his own interviews with people ranging from Woody Allen to Patty Hearst. In the 1960s, The Realist was a voice of the counterculture. On one of his days away from the typewriter, Krasner co-founded the radical group The Yippies with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. Since 1985, Krasner has been publishing The Realist in newsletter form. He also does stand-up comedy, drawing on his past experiences and his current political and social observations. And he's at work on what he describes as his unauthorized autobiography. Krasner once described his editorial philosophy as combining entertainment with the First Amendment. I asked him if that description still holds.
Yes, more and more, especially since the ACLU has become a four-letter word.
Did that surprise you?
It saddens me that, you know, George Bush would say that that the Republicans are for the people, whereas the Democrats are for the ACLU, as if there was a contradiction.
The Realist has always been a very irreverent publication, and as you point out, the rate of irreverence has been accelerating along with everything else. Are you afraid that irreverence is becoming obsolete, that so many people have become irreverent that it doesn't mean what it used to?
Well, I think it's not that it's obsolete so much as that it's become an industry. But what's happened in the process is that, you know, with talk shows like Geraldo and Donahue and Oprah, the taboos have changed totally. The concepts are acceptable now, but it's been the fear of concepts and language has been replaced by fear of litigation. I'll give you an example. One of the things that put me over the edge in deciding to publish The Realist again was when Running Press published Best of the Realist, I had in the introduction a whole series of examples of how the taboos had changed. One of these was that when Dr. Ruth Westheimer appeared on the David Letterman show, she told him that he could improve his love life by varying his foreplay, and she suggested that he have his girlfriend toss French fried onion rings at his waiting erection. Now, this was left out of the introduction, and I asked the editor why, and he said, well, that's actionable. I said, actionable? It's true. He said, well, he didn't watch the Letterman show, and he wasn't familiar with Dr. Ruth. But the point is that even if I had made it up, the fact that somebody would not publish this for fear that either David Letterman or Dr. Ruth would sue, you know, for mental anguish and false image that maybe she was against fried foods, is an indication of how editors and producers always have lawyers looking over their shoulders.
Well, have you ever run into problems with that? Because you've published all kinds of very wild things. Have you ever been sued or worried about being sued?
No. I guess my philosophy is that the stuff that I publish is so outrageous that people would hesitate to sue for fear that they would be put in the position of acting as though people could possibly believe it.
You're doing a stand-up act now. Now, you were one of the founders of the Yippies, and one of the principles of the Yippies was that theater should be a part of politics, that theater should be in the streets, that life should have theater in it. Do you think that things have changed so much that theater's back in the clubs, that to do theater you have to be back on stage?
Well, I think that, again, there's so much, even with, like, the new Gong Show, there's just so much...
Oh, is that
much...
back on the air now?
Yes, uh-huh. But a new version of it, which is even more bizarre. And so, you know, acting bizarre becomes a role model, and it's not to get on the streets, it's to get that 15 minutes on TV, as Andy Warhol said. I guess the supplement to that now is that someday everybody will be ABC's Person of the Week.
You knew Lenny Bruce and actually edited his autobiography. And I was wondering, when you're doing your stand-up, if you think of anything that you learned through watching or talking with Bruce?
A couple of things. One was that he really tried to use four-letter words and profanity in general, for accuracy of character, not for shock value, really. And he would try not to end a punchline on a four-letter word because he didn't want that to get the laugh. He wanted its context to be appreciated. And the other thing, even more important, is that Lenny said that he was part of everything he indicted. And that's like a credo for me because it makes me not act superior to the audience or inferior either.
Mm-hmm. And I should ask you, too, about The Realist. You stopped at, what, 1974?
Yes.
You stopped publication, and recently you brought it back out again in newsletter form, and I was wondering why. Why?
Well, there was this feeling, you know, the fact that we had in the White House an after-dinner speaker, and that people were so easily fooled by image rather than content, it was just an urge to do it again. The time, and most of the mail I got said the time is right again, so that was validation.
Mm-hmm. You started The Realist in 1958, and this was really before the underground press, or at least before the alternative press was given that name of the underground press. Why did you see a need for something like The Realist, for publishing the kinds of things that were either so radical or so bizarre that they wouldn't appear in the mainstream press?
Well, I had been doing freelance stuff for Mad Magazine and for the Steve Allen Show, and I just came in contact with more and more taboos. The first thing I did for Mad Magazine was a thing called If Comic Strip Characters Answered Those Ads on the Back of Magazines. And we had Dick Tracy getting a nose job, alley-oop getting rid of his superfluous hair, and we wanted to have Olive Oil sending away for falsies. And the publisher said, no, he didn't want to do that because his mother would object. And I said, yeah, but your mother's not a typical subscriber. And he said, yes, but she's a typical mother. And, you know, they had a quarter of a million circulation at that time. So there was really no humor for adults in this country, except for maybe cartoons and The New Yorker. This was before Doonesbury, before National Lampoon, before Spy Magazine, before Saturday Night Live. So I had a pretty clear field to say in print what I would say in the living room.
Well, it's one thing to want to start a magazine. It's another thing to actually pull it together and do it. How did you start? How did you finance it?
Well, I was working for a publisher named Lyle Stewart, who published a paper called The Independent, which was kind of a missing link or a forerunner of the underground press. I mean, there's been a tradition going back to George Seldes, in fact, I'd researched it all the way back to the 1890s when there was a publication called The Iconoclast in Waco, Texas. And so I worked out of Lyle Stewart's office and got a mailing list of a Freethought magazine, which had 3,000 names to it, and offered them subscriptions and their money back if they didn't like the first issue. And we got 600 subscriptions to start with, and only one individual asked for their money back.
So tell me more about your vision for The Realist when you started it.
Well, I remember the first thing, I was still living with my parents at the time. I was publishing what was considered the hippest magazine in the country, and I was living with my parents. And I remember they were watching a telethon, and I suddenly blurted out, "This is barbaric." And they looked at me as if I were a Martian. And, of course, in their eyes, I was a Martian. And I think it was a kind of species, a need for community, for an extended family, so that I knew I couldn't be the only Martian on my block, or there was no hope. And so The Realist served as a kind of network for Martians all over the country. And the first thing I published, in fact, in 1958, was a piece, a child's primer on telethons called See the Tired Man, which talked about the contradictions of having the private sector raise money to cure leukemia while the government was exploding test atomic bombs, which had fallout that caused leukemia.
Yeah, it was also, in a way, about how big celebrities exploit telethons for greater audiences to build their own reputation.
And the corollary to that is that the audiences come not even knowing what the cause is. So it's symbiotic.
So let's get back to you living with your parents while publishing this hip magazine. Why were you still living with them? Why didn't you move out into your own apartment?
Well, you know, sometimes it's easier to be courageous in print than it is with your own family.
Well, did it take that much courage to move out? Was the problem that you didn't have the money or that they wanted you to stay?
Well, actually, I tapered off from living there. I got a little apartment near my office, but I didn't tell them about it, and it had the same phone number, so they would just think that I was working late a lot of times.
Oh, so why didn't they want you to move out, though?
Well, it was just, you know, I remember I told my mother once that I was thinking of getting an apartment, and she said, why? And I said, well, I don't have any place to be alone with a girl, as they were called in those years. And she said, well, Dad and I will step into the other room. And I said, no, I mean really alone. And she went and she took a shower and came out and said that any girl who does that is a tramp. I mean, this was, you know, the late 50s, and we were a very puritanical culture. And it was just, it just caused a lot of emotional upset.
Did they think it would look bad if you lived alone and you weren't married yet?
I think they thought it would look as if it was their failure, in a certain sense, that I didn't stay with them.
Well, they must have thought it was pretty peculiar, all the material that you were bringing home and publishing.
My mother said to me, she said, you know more about birth control than I do.
In The Realist, you've never really differentiated between satire and journalism. So you'll have this really wacky piece that makes all kinds of impossible charges that's satire, but someone could read it and think it was real. And then you'll have an investigative story that someone might think was really a joke, but it's actually true. And I guess I'm surprised in a way that never got you into really serious trouble.
Oh, I think it's protected me in a way. I mean, first of all, I just never wanted to take away the pleasure from the readers of discerning for themselves whether something was actual or made up. And but I've tried to second guess attorneys. I mean, I never let an attorney read The Realist until it was published, so that then they could say, "Well, you shouldn't have done that."
right, but they can't stop it.
I did get sued once for calling another journalist a liar in print, and that did come to court, and I won because we were able to prove to the jury that he had indeed lied.
Let me read something that Mort Saul said to you in an interview that you did with him, and this is published in the anthology of The Realist, and I'll confess that I don't know what year you did this interview in.
That would have been, I think, probably 63, right before the assassination of President Kennedy.
Okay. So here's what Mort Saul says. He says, I think The Realist is probably the most vital publication in the United States, but I'm not giving fodder to any bigots when I say to you, I don't think the magazine should dissipate its time on crudeness, and I think there's an appetite in the magazine for crudeness. I think you're evading responsibility by making out that the whole world is a hoax, the whole world is a put-on, morality is a put-on. In other words, I think you confuse Puritanism and morality. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I remember in talking to Mort Saul, I asked him about making so many jokes about integration, about segregation, rather, and he said, well, it's implicit that he's for integration. And I think, you know, if I would make fun of certain things, there would be between the lines, without being preachy, the standards were there, you know. In other words, if I would make fun of the laws against abortion, it would be fairly implicit that I was for free choice. And in fact, I went over the line as a journalist and became an underground abortion referral service during the 60s after publishing an interview with an anonymous abortionist. This started in 1962. There was an article in Look magazine about abortion, and in it they said that there was no such thing as a humane abortionist. And there was this, the late Dr. Robert Spencer was known around the nation as the saint because he helped pregnant women sometimes for $5 if that's all they could afford. He was in Ashland, Pennsylvania. And so I asked him for an interview. He happened to be a subscriber, and told him that I would go to prison sooner than reveal his name. And so once I published it, I began getting calls from people who, even nurses in hospitals, who had no access to safe abortions.
Well, I want to talk with you about some more of your experiences, and I want to ask you about founding the Yippies and some of your experiences in the 60s, and then I want to find out what you've been doing recently. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Paul Krasner, who is the founder and publisher of the Realist, which is a radical magazine that he founded in 1958 and that he recently resurrected in newsletter form. He also co-founded the Yippies with Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. He now does a stand-up comedy act, which he describes as investigative satire. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Paul Krasner is my guest. You started The Realist before the 60s counterculture. So here we go with the big question. What was your first drug experience? How did you first start doing LSD or marijuana?
Oh, well, that came about. Actually, I had been publishing material defending the right to smoke marijuana and to take LSD before I actually did.
Uh-huh.
Robert Anton
Wilson. So you're defending
Wilson.
It on
again, the
as
right
a principle
to choice.
Before you, yeah, right.
As just an individual right. And the Robert Anton Wilson had gone to Millbrook, the drug research center of Tim Leary and Richard Alpert and Ralph Metzner, and he had written an article for The Realist about it called calling LSD the a psychological H-bomb. And shortly after I published that, Tim Leary called me and invited me to come up to Millbrook in upstate New York. And I went there for and just started doing research on LSD. And after 6 months, not only reading about it, but also talking with these minds, figuring that if that was brain damage, I was willing to risk it. And then I took it at Millbrook. My guide was a man named Michael Hollingshead, who first introduced Tim Leary to the drug.
Mm-hmm. Was your first experience a good one?
It was strange because it was so good. I called up my wife, with whom I was separating, to thank her for providing this wonderful experience. And she kept telling me that, you're telling me you love me for something I didn't do. So it was very interesting for myself, who was publishing a magazine that had supposedly a rational basis, to be in such an irrational space, and it was a good learning experience.
Did you feel when you started doing a lot of LSD that your priorities changed, or that your worldview changed, what you wanted out of life was changed?
No, I think I had already, it just solidified it. You know, I mean, I had a kind of atheistic outlook, and a lot of people had a religious experience with LSD, and I just found a larger variety of gods not to believe in.
You were one of the founders of the Yippies with Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, and it was you who actually coined the name. So why don't you tell us how you did it, how you came up with it?
Well, we were having a meeting. This was on the afternoon of December 31st, 1967, on the Lower East Side of New York at the home of Abbie and Anita Hoffman. There were several of us there, and we were planning a festival of life to go as a protest to the Democratic Convention in Chicago that year, in the coming year, 1968. And I, as a journalist, knew that reporters need the who for the who, what, when, where, and why. And I remembered that a few months before that, the Diggers, which were sort of psychedelic social workers in San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury, that they had held a parade for the death of hippie because they felt that it had become such a media exploited term. So they wanted to be called Free Americans, which was, you know, you don't find people yelling, "Get a haircut, you lousy Free American." So I knew that it needed something else, and I started going through the alphabet, ippy, bippy, kippy, dippy, and was about to give up when I said yippy to myself, and realized that would be perfect, and then worked backwards to see what acronym that could come from.
Because everything has to be an acronym, right?
Well, just to give it an organic derivation, even though I was working backwards.
Uh-huh.
And so the letters Y, I, and P, Yippies would derive out of that. And then again, working backwards, I saw that the words youth and international and party were so appropriate because it was a youth movement, it was international, and it was a party in both senses of the word.
How did you manage to be a founder of the Yippies yet not get indicted in the Chicago conspiracy trial?
Well, I was one of the... They originally had a list of 20 that they were going to indict. a few of us, Bob Fass from WBAI in New York, and Ed Sanders, and Stu Albert, and myself, were all journalists, and the word was they didn't want to make it a First Amendment thing, and they reduced it to 8 who were the most visible, and also 8 cops had been indicted, so I guess that was the scales of justice being balanced.
You've written about how during the Chicago conspiracy trial, you decided to drop acid before testifying, and what you decided to do was to, when you were sworn in, you decided to refuse to tell the truth?
Oh, well, no, the thing about LSD was that, like any catalyst for coming to grips with your subconscious, whether it's Aikido, Zen, yoga, meditation, LSD was a reminder that you're always making choices every moment, even if action seems spontaneous. There are choices being made at the basis of it. And so I was so zonked out that when the bailiff said, "Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God," I said no, because I thought he was offering me a choice. But within the core of my reality, I knew, and then I then stated that I choose to affirm to tell the truth rather than swear in the Bible, which is my right under the First Amendment. So it was just it just happened very theatrically, but I remembered my lesson from civics class in junior high school.
When you look back on your experiences in the 60s and early 70s, are they experiences that you feel really glad you went through, that you or that you feel slightly embarrassed about now? I'm always interested in how people look back on the period.
Oh, no, I wouldn't have missed them for anything. Mm-hmm. No, I'm not embarrassed. I guess Orson Bean reminded me the other day of something I guess I'm embarrassed about. He and I were on some TV show in Cleveland, and at that time my hair was extremely long, and I was wearing a hat most of the time, a floppy black hat. And we went into a Chinese restaurant before the TV show, and the waiter asked what the lady will have, meaning me. So I guess that I was embarrassed about that.
Let me ask you about the question of sexism. When you were one of many people singled out as being an example of people in the cultural or political left who were sexist in the way that they thought about women or wrote about women. And I was wondering how feminism initially affected you and how you feel you've been changed by it.
Well, you know, I always thought I was a feminist, and I always thought I was super conscious, but there are always more and more layers of oneself to be revealed. And so, for example, what I thought was a joke that feminists would approve of at the time, this would have been in the late 60s, was about that there should be a rape-in of legislators' wives, so that they could get impregnated, and then their husbands would vote for abortion rights. And feminists accused me of sexism in that because it said I was, you know, making victims of the legislators' wives when they hadn't done anything. And I had resistance at first. Nobody likes to be, you know, to have their material corrected, but I realized there was some truth to it and changed the material.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you know, you still have to remain true to yourself. I've gotten criticized for talking about the absurdity of turkey basters being used for artificial insemination, I haven't dropped that from my performances because I think that the absurdity of turkey basters transcends gender difference.
I'm sure in the 60s that You always wondered if you were followed by the FBI and what was in your FBI files. I don't know if you ever filed under the Freedom of Information Act.
Oh, no, I got my files.
You got your files?
And my CIA files, both, yeah.
What's one of the most interesting things in your file?
I guess the most frightening was that in 1969, the FBI published and distributed anonymously a flyer which had on it a swastika, large swastika, and in each square of the swastika was a photo of Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, Mark Rudd of SDS, and myself. And then the headline said, "Lampshades, lampshades, lampshades." And The copy underneath said that the only way that oppressed blacks would get rid of their oppression would be for the elimination of these Jewish leaders. And then the approval letter from the Washington office of the FBI said that the publication and distribution of this flyer should not be traceable to the Bureau. This flyer, which mentions which has the facetious suggestion for the elimination of these leaders. So I guess they were covering their tracks, though if anybody killed us, they could say, well, we said facetious. So that was the most frightening thing, and especially that it was being done with taxpayers' money.
Did you ever get rid of the paranoia that there was maybe somebody tapping your phone or following you?
Well, I tried to avoid the paranoia by having as a criterion that everything I said was on the record. And so I virtually had no secrets, except perhaps the name of my marijuana dealer. But everything I did was really legal. There was one demonstration that I got arrested for, and they dismissed it for lack of evidence, and the judge started lecturing us, saying, next time, don't tempt fate. And I started arguing. I said, well, wait, is freedom of assembly tempting fate? And my lawyer jabbed me in the ribs and said, shh, quiet, this is my first case. Don't blow it for me.
You started publishing The Realist before the blossoming of the alternative press. What's your assessment of the alternative press today?
There's the alternative press, which is in so many cities, weeklies, which are distributed free and are supported by advertising. And there's a whole spectrum of them, and some of them are extremely political, and some of them are more fashion-oriented. But there's also an underground press, an alternative to the alternatives, which is developing. There are like maybe half a dozen in Boston alone. And I got a letter from a 14-year-old kid in Illinois who's starting his own paper called The Radical. So it's sort of like a replay of the 60s, but with a loss of innocence.
Okay. Well, listen, Paul Krasner, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Paul Krasner, who was the founder and publisher of The Realist. He founded it in 1958, recently resurrected it, and now publishes it in newsletter form. He now also does stand-up comedy weekly at the Odyssey Theater in Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.